May it please the court, I'm Jim Griffin, firm of Griffin and Hackett, and I would like to introduce John Shoreman, who's admitted pro hoc vici for this matter, who will argue for the appellant. Thank you.
Welcome to the court.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I think that the fundamental issue before the court is whether the parties to the agreement that was entered into between BPS and PDI is subject to the Delaware Uniform Arbitration Act. The agreement was entered into in 1998, and it includes a broad arbitration provision which basically submits all disputes that arise between the parties to arbitration. Around 2000, my client claims there was a breach of the contract, which didn't resolve itself. In 2003, the appellant, BPS, filed two notices of intent to arbitrate. Now, admittedly, it did reference in those notices the Delaware Uniform Arbitration Act, although it stated in those notices also that the location of the arbitration would be Washington, D.C., and it included in those notices statements that an agreement for the parties to bind themselves to the rules of the American Arbitration Association. Negotiations concerning the dispute. PDI responded in 2003 with a response, an informal response, stating that it would object to the venue. It turns out until February of 2008, PDI had always wanted the venue of the arbitration to be in Milwaukee. In 2003, the parties did not resolve themselves. The notices of intent to arbitrate were submitted, and those notices of intent to arbitrate laid out fully the claims that BPS had against PDI. They weren't simply a notice that met the service requirements or to set forth. It laid out in detail what the claims would be. Now, 4 years passed before BPS submitted a demand for arbitration to the American Arbitration Association. That demand, which was filed in August 10th, 2007, was filed strictly with the AAA. It didn't reference the Delaware Uniform Arbitration Act whatsoever. It submitted the arbitration to the rules of the AAA. The arbitration clause between the parties states that the parties would choose a neutral arbitrator through the processes of the AAA. And it's our argument that basically brings the rules of the AAA into the dispute, because when you submit to the AAA, absent a party's full agreement as to what rules will govern the procedures going forth, of course, the arbitrator will apply the existing rules of the AAA, and that's what was the intention of the parties here. So the question that arises is, was it through mistake of the parties, when there was a statement made back in the notices in 2003, mistakenly it was stated that the arbitration would proceed under the Delaware Arbitration Act. That was the mistake of BPS at the time, but there was never mutual assent to the Delaware Arbitration Act being applied in this case. PDI filed a motion to enjoin pursuant to the Arbitration Act, and the court at that point raised for the first time the question: does it actually have subject matter jurisdiction, or is this a matter better left to the Federal Arbitration Act? And in fact, all the indications, in the absence of any demonstrative evidence that the parties mutually intended to submit this to the Delaware Act, this case should be subject to the Federal Arbitration Act, meaning that the Chancery Court does not have subject matter jurisdiction to enter the injunction in this case.
The parties could have expressly required arbitration under the Act, right?
Under the Delaware Act.
But that was not done.
As the Chancellor laid out in his opinion, the 27-page opinion, very thoroughly, the contract does not make any reference to the Delaware Uniform Arbitration Act itself. It does not state so. The only reference the scope of the arbitration clause itself states that after 30 days, if after a dispute arises, 30 days will pass. If the parties can't work it out, they will go to the AAA and select an arbitrator.
Well, is it your position that an express reference is required as a matter of law?
To bring it within the Delaware Act, yes, Your Honor. That as a matter of law, that you cannot, the parties cannot submit themselves, absent the contract speaking as to the Delaware, or a specific statement in the contract that they, that the parties have agreed to accept the Delaware Uniform Arbitration Act, or in the case of in the Fidelity case where we saw the parties had actually arbitrated in Delaware and submitted to you know, post-hearing processes before the court. Here there was no arbitration in Delaware.
So course of conduct can invoke the Delaware Uniform Arbitration Act?
Well, it's course of conduct that has a clear, unambiguous, demonstrably evident course of conduct. But here, there's nothing but ambiguity and confusion throughout. I mean, the only time following the briefing below, letters were submitted to the court, and on February 6, 2008, a letter came in from PDI stating that the Delaware Act should apply, and that it was withdrawing its request for an arbitration in Milwaukee to Delaware. BPS responded, of course, it doesn't apply, and it was withdrawing its request for an arbitration in Delaware. The court, the Chancery Court, stated in its memorandum and opinion, in the words of Chancellor Stein, the record of communications in tussle after my letter establishes that the parties never agreed to arbitrate in Delaware. So it's established that the parties have never agreed to arbitrate in Delaware. The court below asserted subject matter jurisdiction on the basis of basically an equitable basis that BPS had used the term Delaware Uniform Arbitration Act in those early notices and had not objected at the time of the injunction proceedings in its briefs. But the fact is, can a party, through mistake, without mutual assent, without both parties agreeing, subject a matter to the subject matter jurisdiction of the court under the Delaware Uniform Arbitration Act? In this case, no matter how you view the confusion and the course of the transaction of the parties, there was no point in time where they ever agreed together to litigate this, to arbitrate this in Delaware. And the agreement states that it will be governed by Delaware law, but of course that's the substantive law of Delaware under this court's precedent that doesn't establish application of the DUAA. And of course, federal precedent is a very strong presumption that the FAA applies, absent an indication by the parties that they wish to displace the Federal Arbitration Act with state law. And that simply doesn't, that kind of clarity, that demonstrable evidence that's required, which the Supreme Court has spoken of in the Ferrer case and elsewhere, is simply not present here. And the Supreme Court has mentioned in the Ferrer case that when parties refer to the AAA rules in their arbitration provision, that alone is enough to bring the case within the scope of the FAA, because the American arbitration rules assert that procedural arbitrability issues, which that's what this case is all about. This case goes down to a statute of limitations defense. Should that be considered by the Chancery Court here under the DUAA, or should it be considered by the arbitrator under the Federal Act? Well, when parties use the AAA rules, the AAA rules provide the arbitrator a broad scope of authority. All issues of procedural arbitrability are submitted to the arbitrator. So the question really is it the arbitrator's job to decide whether PDI has a defense based on latches or delay or statute of limitations, or is it the Chancery Court? My client's argument is that under the clear and demonstrative evidence rules that have been established by the Supreme Court, there's nothing in this case that comes close to that level. The parties were in the parties never reached a point where there was mutual assent that this case should be considered within Delaware in a venue in Delaware pursuant to the DUAA. There was a mistake, but there was never a reason. So this case initially when the notices were issued and referenced the DUAA back in 2003, they also requested a venue. BPS's request was for a venue in Washington, D.C. So even though it made the reference to the DUAA, it was basically contradicting itself when it stated, we're going to arbitrate this in Washington, D.C. And, of course, the other side then objected and said, we're going to arbitrate this in Milwaukee. Neither side in 2003 was interested in arbitrating this in Delaware, which you know, given the...
You know, sure. Accepting that as a fact, why nonetheless, that is, what is it, what rule of law precludes the parties from agreeing voluntarily that wherever the arbitration is going to be held, that the Delaware Uniform Arbitration Act would apply?
Well, the parties could do that, certainly. And the parties could agree clearly, but that agreement would have to be clear and demonstrative. It would have to be supported by clear, demonstrative evidence.
Well,
it can't
there
be
was
supported by confusion.
There was clear, demonstrative evidence that both parties were relying on the DUAA. But putting to one side where the arbitration would be located, isn't that right?
No, I can't agree with that, Your Honor. I can't agree that both parties ever at the same time agreed.
Well, how do you deal with the pleadings that were made in the Court of Chancery?
Well, the pleadings that were made in the Court of Chancery flowed from the transactions, and really the Court of Chancery itself.
So there were judicial admissions, weren't they, that were made in the Court of Chancery?
No, Your Honor, I can't accept that they were judicial admissions. I believe that when we're dealing with subject matter jurisdiction, it's either there or it isn't. Parties can't approach it, then back away, and approach it, and back away.
I'm not sure what that means.
Well,
I understand that there may not be clarity on the point of whether the parties agreed that Delaware would be the site of the arbitration. But I thought that the undisputed facts were that until the Vice Chancellor raised the issue of whether the DUAA was technically applicable because of that non-Delaware situs, that there was no dispute about it. That is, there was no dispute about the related issue of whether the DUAA would constitute the source of law that would be used to decide the case.
Well, the dispute had not been raised at that point. Of course, it was raised before the Chancery Court, Your Honor.
There wasn't any dispute, then there was agreement.
Well, there wasn't agreement because the parties never really, neither party ever really addressed the subject. Each party was dancing around the subject. One was talking about the claim had been submitted in 2007, August, in August of 2007. The claim was submitted to the AAA.
Okay, so your point is that there was no subject matter jurisdiction in Delaware because the parties had not explicitly agreed in the contract that the DUAA would apply?
That, not only there's a lack of explicit agreement in the contract, Your Honor, but there's also a lack of any evidence through their course of dealing that they ever agreed at any time to arbitrate
in the court. And the court was wrong in finding otherwise.
Well, the court never found that the parties came to an agreement to arbitrate in Delaware.
No, but the court did find that the parties had an agreement that the DUAA would apply.
The court found through what it considered two aspects in that regard. It considered what it termed the course of performance under the contract and the equities of the situation. The course of performance that the court relied upon seem to focus almost entirely on the notices of 2003 and the fact that, and it led into the equitable argument that since BPS...
Well, be that as it may, there was a factual finding by the court on that point. Is that
there was
right?
a factual finding that the DUAA applied based on the course of conduct of the...
And you're arguing that that factual finding was not supported by the record?
It's not supported by the record, as that record must be interpreted under the federal law, because the federal law, the Supreme Court requires to displace the FAA in a contract that doesn't...
I'm sorry, I don't understand what you just said. Are we supposed to wear glasses that are peculiar to people that arbitrate under the federal law in order to understand the print that's either in the opinion or in the what I thought were undisputed facts of record?
No, Your Honor, it's not undisputed. I don't understand that. It's certainly disputed by BPS and has been since the Chancellor raised
it. What I don't understand is why you qualified your answer. You know, I asked whether the finding that the court made was, you're claiming it was incorrect, and
yes.
You're saying it was.
I'm saying it was, Your Honor, based upon the requirements of federal law, which basically under federal law, the Federal Arbitration Act preempts the application of the DUAA in this case, in the absence of an explicit agreement among the parties. You can't displace the Federal Arbitration Act, which based upon a transaction record of confusion and conflict. It has to be clear and demonstrative if the purposes of the Federal Arbitration
does
Act.
That mean,
given
does that mean that it has to be in the agreement, or can there still be... an agreement on that point that's found to be clear, even though it's not in writing.
I think, Your Honor, it does need to be in the agreement, and in the absence of it to be in agreement, it has to be in writing that the parties have subjected themselves to the DUAA and are stepping away from the FAA, particularly when they've submitted themselves to the American Arbitration Association, where the scope of arbitrability would include this question of a time bar. I see I'm well into my summation period. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court. I'm Dan Fulton of Duane Morris here for Personal Decisions, Inc. We agree with our friends that the fundamental issue before the Court is whether or not the DUAA should govern arbitrability in this case. We think there's four reasons that support it, and from those four reasons, two key points, one involving a fine distinction that I think Justice Jacobs was alluding to. The first reason, foremost reason, and I think perhaps the key question, is whether the Court of Chancery was correct to conclude that if it found overwhelming evidence that the parties agreed that the DUAA would govern their proceedings, as distinguished from that the proceedings would occur in Delaware, that was sufficient as a matter of law and policy to invoke its jurisdiction. Justice Jacobs asked a few moments ago counsel if there was any rule of law that would preclude that finding, and to the best of our knowledge, the answer is no.
Does the statute require a written agreement or not, expressly stating that parties agree to be subject to DUAA?
Our client's position is it does not. And looking at the cases, we haven't been able to find any cases that suggest an absolute writing requirement. Whether that writing is the contract itself or whether that writing would be some subsequent writing, as counsel suggested. The two cases that...
You're talking about the Delaware statute now?
Yes. The two cases that seemed closest to point to us was, first, the general concept comes from Dressler Industries. Dressler says the party's agreement to arbitrate in Delaware confirms its jurisdiction. Certainly the most reliable way to invoke that jurisdiction is to include it in a party's contract. But what happens when that doesn't take place? In that case, we look to the Star Technologies decision and the opinion that we quoted in our briefs from Chancellor Chandler. And he basically states that an explicit provision is not required. He says an agreement may be inferred. If agreement may be inferred, arguably it could be inferred from course of conduct. Then there's a question, I think, of whether the course of conduct can be equivocal or unequivocal, and those facts, I think, would inform the court. I and its decision. And the Court of Chancery made two decisions in this case, which I think are important. Our first point was it did decide, I think it's on page 9 of its decision, rejecting our argument, which we reasserted in our appellate briefs, that there was evidence from which a court reasonably could conclude that there was a single point in time in which the parties did have an agreement to actually arbitrate physically in Delaware. The trial court rejected that. But the trial court said there was overwhelming evidence and no dispute whatsoever that the parties mutually agreed and always operated under the understanding that the DOAA applied. In fact, Justice Jacobs asked about that question, and on page 11 of the court's decision, Vice Chancellor Stein wrote, quote, and as counsel for business planning readily admitted at oral argument, business planning thought the parties were proceeding under the DOAA. Close quote, a citation at footnote 25.
Mr. Folk, I understand, I mean, related to that point, I understand Mr. Shurman to be arguing that it's not enough to have evidence that the parties, agreed that the DOAA would apply, unless that evidence takes the form of some writing, either in the arbitration agreement itself or some other cognizable agreement, then the federal law trumps everything and displaces whatever potential applicability of the Delaware statute might exist. How do you respond to that?
I think in three parts. First, we looked and couldn't find any case that imposed to RI principle that there had to be a writing, an explicit writing. Again, certainly the preferred course, but no case that we could see that supported that provision or struck down that position, that really squarely considered the proposition that the consent to invoke the DOAA had to be in writing, and we think that Star Technologies suggests otherwise.
I'm sorry, but I guess the question would, the argument that's being advanced here appears to be one under federal law. And I suppose the question would be whether there's any federal authority that would support the point of view that Mr. Shurman articulated.
And my answer to that question, Your Honor, is not that we could find. And my second point of my earlier answer was going to be counsel writes about and argues understandably about the presumption under federal law. There is a presumption under federal law. But what is a presumption? Well, jurisdiction under arbitration is unique. Jurisdiction under arbitration arises by virtue of agreements. Either it's invoked or not when parties agree. And this basically calls into play pretty common contract principles, which the judges of our courts deal with all the time. And contract principles, of course, honor as their cardinal principle the intent of the parties. If the parties, if you stop and think practically, at least if I think practically to help myself walk through this, if you take a place like Delaware or St. Louis or Minneapolis, where state lines run right between a city, and if the parties agree that the DOAA would govern a dispute, but decide for convenience or any reason that they might actually meet in arbitration in Media, Pennsylvania instead of Newcastle County, if that was the unequivocal, undisputed manifestation of the party's intent, how do we honor that intent? If intent can trigger jurisdiction under the DOAA, is that reasonable? I think it is. I don't think any federal case suggests otherwise. What the federal cases do say in great length about the presumption is it's a presumption, and you apply the presumption when you are lacking a clear manifestation of intent. Vice Chancellor Stein said that there could be no misunderstanding. His words were strong, not my words, overwhelming evidence that the parties always had this intent and understanding to proceed under the DOAA. That is contrary to what we said about the other part of the argument. Was there mutual assent, even though not in writing, to arbitrate physically in Delaware? Earlier, with the help of court staff, I provided Mr. Shurman and Mr. Griffin a copy of just a simple tie line. I think Your Honors have been provided with it. And just a few comments on that. I just tried to put the dates down. We start with the date of contract in 1998. It does contain a choice of law provision. As I wrote very candidly in our papers, I believe that question is not decided by this court. If I had to predict how this court would decide it, mindful that my history in predicting this court's outcome is pretty poor, so I'd disqualify myself, but I think a majority of courts have found that a choice of law provision is not sufficient, standing alone in isolation by itself to infer the decision to arbitrate in Delaware. But I don't think this court has decided it. Perhaps it will make that clear in this case. And so we have not come to this court and asked it to find a ruling that that choice of law clause standing alone is enough. Then we get to the first notice was sent by BPS on March 19, 2003. Now, counsel said both notices invoked Washington as a locale. That may or not be true. That certainly Washington as a locale was expressly set forth in the second notice, even though it did contain the same DUAA language. The first notice, which I reread when counsel mentioned it, is a little vaguer. All it says in that notice is we're filing this in Washington and invoking these rules. And the idea that they have mentioned that the actual contract provision itself invokes the rules either for the FAA or the AAA, and that under federal law is a strong presumption in their favor, I don't think that factually or legally is correct. What the rules have, first off, there's nothing in the contract provision that says we're going to use the FAA or AAA rules. It simply provides a mechanism for picking arbiters, and it's in the disjunctive. There's two ways you may do it. One option is the parties can agree. They can go anywhere under any system they want and choose an arbiter. The second way that they could proceed is they could pick an arbiter off of the approved AAA list. I think that factually, we would argue factually, that's different than a wholesale incorporation of the rules. But in any event, Delaware appears in the contract. It appears in the first and second notice. This is telegraphing a message about the governability of the DUAA to our clients. Our clients do respond on the 15th. It says just here, denies liability, but we put in our briefs, and I say again on the record, that our client, I think, did come back and say, yes, we'll proceed. It didn't reject the DUAA, but it did reject the concept of Washington from the second notice. It said it ought to be Minneapolis. The statute then expired, and then we get a demand almost 4 years later, and in the demand, there is a clear and unequivocal assertion of Delaware as a locale. Now, our client comes back on February 6th. That's the day Vice Chancellor Strine brought us into court to discuss the DUAA argument, I think in our letter, but certainly in the oral argument that followed. We told the court that the affirmative defense that had been filed prior to our involvement in the case, so we withdrew it. We said we understand they have a Delaware locale, and we withdraw that. And therefore, at least today, right now, there's a single point in contact. Now, I wouldn't be surprised if the court looked at that and said, boy, that's kind of a gotcha. Now that you know you have this problem, you're coming in and you're doing that. And if you look at this, you could play gotchas both ways. I think Vice Chancellor Strine was correct. The parties always had an understanding about the DUAA, but they never were really on the same page. I think a reasonable party could conclude, our client would maintain, that there was a single point in time in which there was assent to arbitrate in Delaware. But if the court were to reject that, and I wouldn't for a minute suggest that would be unreasonable, I don't think that there's any evidence anywhere consistent with the admissions that there wasn't an agreement to be governed by the DUAA. And I think that raised, so the second point about locale raises a question of evidence that the Vice Chancellor rejected that we advanced. And the first question raises a question of policy or contract interpretation. That's really the interesting one, because there really isn't a case anywhere that we could find that says, well, you don't absolutely have to be in writing, but if you have a course of conduct and we can imply assent, is it enough to assent in the governance of the DUAA, or do you actually have to assent to the physical location? I think in some ways the Court of Chancery broke new ground in that area, and that presents a novel question that this court will decide consistent with the policy reasons. I could talk about the policy reasons, but I would never like to compete with my policy discussions with that of the Vice Chancellor, who went on for many pages why he thought that was consistent with all of the rules of the arbitration. I thought he stated it pretty well. He summarizes the evidence in page 11 and 12 of his decision, and we thought that was effective. The third and fourth points that arguably could support our argument are small, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on them. There is the concept of quasi-estoppel, and the support for that, I think, comes the Vice Chancellor cited a federal court decision for that.
Well, but doesn't estoppel go both ways on this record? I mean, everybody flip-flopped, didn't they?
I'm not disagreeing. I'm thinking about that. I think there are times and places and facts and circumstances where the concept of estoppel would apply both ways. Yes, I agree with that. In this case, I think it's hard to separate the court's reliance on quasi-estoppel from waiver, which the court noted was an alternative basis, to equity. And by equity, I don't think the court was mixing the need to balance equities in conjunction with the preliminary injunction test. I think he was just concerned about one side having asserted the DOAA fairly consistency, even with locale differences, all the way, and then only when the Court of Chancery brought it up, suggesting otherwise. Now, in the opening brief and appeal, BPS makes the argument that they challenged subject matter jurisdiction. I think that's inaccurate. They challenged the statutory basis. They never made an argument in the court below. Neither side did, not to any counsel's credit, myself totally included, didn't really stop and think about the requirement of the locale. And the Vice Chancellor pointed that out. The Vice Chancellor had another case out there with which we all probably should have saw and thought about and dealt with that at least originally, but it didn't come up. So it came up later, and it was at that point in time that BPS, who at least at the point in time, fairly contemporaneously, 4 years later, 7 years after the case had been filed, in bringing their action, listed Delaware as their locale, rejecting Minneapolis, which had been advanced by our client, rejecting Washington, which they had done before. It was only on at that time when they realized it might be an out to this procedure that they did it. Under the quasi-estoppel doctrine in this case, it's a little bit different from this court's frequent reliance on concepts like judicial estoppel or equitable estoppel. There are varieties of estoppels that are discussed in our own jurisprudence. But it says quasi-estoppel applies when it would be unconscionable to allow a person to maintain a position inconsistent with one to which he acquiesced or from which he accepted a benefit. It's an equitable doctrine preventing one from repudiating an act or assertion if it would harm another who reasonably relied. The court felt that our client reasonably relied on the serial references to the DOAA to come in and that the reliance arose from the fact that so much litigation has resulted. So there was money and time spent bringing the proceeding initially in the Court of Chancery, working that through to a preliminary injunction process, and then following thereafter into this appeal.
Well, in terms of your reasonable reliance argument and perhaps even more broadly, I hear both sides saying that nobody even thought about this and that they just kind of proceeded along without any analysis of whether it should be the DUAA or not or federal arbitration. And that the trial court said, hey, shouldn't we take a look at this, at which point, both parties did. Given that kind of the manner in which this issue finally came to light, doesn't that really give each side the opportunity to say, oh, okay, well, now that we've had a chance to look at it, this is what we believe we're entitled to. Why should they be required to live with something that both sides acknowledge was kind of thoughtless as opposed to a considered evaluation of what their rights were?
Justice Berger, I concur with all of your facts. I think they're accurate. I think that the question is whether one party, the other party, BPS, was content to operate under the DOAA all the way through the process. Our client never objected to DOAA. It was content with that as a governing or administrating body all the way. The parties had a locale difference. It was only when Vice Chancellor Strein, frankly, educated counsel about the applicability that it became an issue. Having gone that far on that record and those facts, this court found that balance the equities, which I think arguably would be subject to an abuse of discretion standard in doing so, that it was inappropriate to assign the risks the way he did. And so we would say, as I'm short on time, that we think estoppel or quasi-estoppel is not the doctrine we rely on principally. Those doctrines and waiver we've talked about, we believe they're applicable. But we think that as a matter of law and policy, the first argument, that mutual assent established by an unequivocal course of conduct ought to support the assertion of jurisdiction under the DUAA as a matter of policy, because as in the example I gave with Media PA, it's reasonable to think that sophisticated commercial parties might agree to a governing law and yet still want some flexibility to do that. In Delaware, a state where we honor rigorously the freedoms of principles of contract, it seems to me reasonable to enforce the expectations of the parties consistent with those freedoms. If there are no more questions, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Just a few brief comments. The question of whether the court below considered subject matter jurisdiction, it was, letters were submitted to the court and the court fully discussed it at a hearing. It certainly was before the court below as to whether subject matter jurisdiction existed, and of course that's reflected in the opinion. This issue as to whether there was a point in time where each party agreed that Delaware should be the venue, therefore the Delaware Act is applicable, didn't exist, and Chancellor Schrein found that. He specifically found on page 9 of his opinion that the parties never agreed to arbitrate in Delaware. So it wasn't a part of his analysis. And of course, up until February of 2008, whenever BPS said Delaware, PDI said Minneapolis. I'm sorry, I said Milwaukee earlier. It's Minneapolis. So there's this tussle that the Chancellor referred to. It's ambiguity, it's vague, it's confused, which goes back to the Supreme Court statement in Preston, which is that in order that the parties must unequivocally demonstrate an intent to displace the default federal standard, meaning that unless the parties clearly, unequivocally demonstrate that they wish to use the Delaware Act, then they will be using the Federal Arbitration Act.
Looking at the language of the arbitration clause, the first provision about agreeing on an arbitrator, and then the alternative about using the AAA, does that demonstrate an intent not to proceed under the Federal Act?
No, not at all, Your Honor. The fact that it references the AAA in any way, shape, or form without detailing its own rules of procedure, I mean, if it had said, we're going to use the AAA to pick an arbitrator, and when we have that arbitrator, he or she will apply these rules, what we've established among ourselves, and this will occur in Delaware, then without anything more explicit than that, you would have a Delaware arbitration, subject to the Delaware Arbitration Act. But here it simply said, if we can't find somebody ourselves, we're going to submit this to the AAA. And having said that, it's implied that the parties have submitted themselves to the broad scope that a AAA arbitrator would use absent agreed-upon rules.
Let's subdivide that. Let's take the first part. We're going to agree to pick somebody ourselves. Let's assume it stops there. Is that enough to demonstrate an intent not to proceed under the FAA?
No, Your Honor. No, Your Honor. I think you'd have to go further and say, we're going to pick someone ourselves, and we're going to be subject to the DUAA under the current federal law. Because if it's without that level of specificity, without that clarity, the FAA is applicable.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
We appreciate the arguments of counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement, and we are adjourned.